was where it was coming from. The voice drifted out of the hole in the living death tree like a fog, spread over the entire farm, covering every blade of grass, covering every leaf that dangled on the verge of falling, covering it all with my name. Aiden Lockwood. The farm itself seemed to call out to me. I moved through the cold, dewy grass until I reached the railroad tie bridge that spanned Sugar Creek. It was an ancient crossing my great-grandfather Lockwood had made, according to my dad, back during the Great Depression, when the farm came into his possession. And when I crossed over those old logs a moment later and stood in front of the living death tree, looking up into its canopy of leafless, gnarled branches, the voice finally, thankfully, fell to a whisper. "Aiden," the voice said. "Aiden Lockwood. You are a good boy, aren't you?" "I don't know," I said. Then I asked, What are you?" The voice didn't say anything right away. Then it began to croon what sounded like a lullaby in a foreign language. A mournful song from some other time and some other country drifted out of the hole in the living death tree. I stood there listening, and felt tears spring to my eyes, as if I could understand those words, as if I could comprehend the sadness and their mysterious meanings. After a while, the singing stopped, and the next thing the voice said was, "Close your eyes, young one. I have something to show you." But even as I closed my eyes, like the good boy she'd called me, another voice sounded suddenly, out of thin air. This new voice, though, came from behind me. "Aiden Lockwood," the new voice said, and I turned away from the living death tree to find my mom standing on the railroad tie bridge, Sugar Creek trickling beneath her, the red morning sunlight edging the frame of our house behind her. She had folded her arms across her chest to hold her robe together, and she wore a pair of old rubber boots that belonged to my dad, which she must have put on in a hurry when she noticed I was missing. They engulfed her legs, and I almost laughed at the sight of her. She seemed like a figure out of a dream or a nightmare. "What are you doing out here?" she asked. Her lips formed a firm line after they closed on her question, and her eyes scanned me from top to bottom, then back again, making me look down and realize that I was wearing only the boxer shorts I'd gone to bed in. My feet and ankles were streaked with mud, and I was shivering, even though I hadn't felt the cold until my mom called my name and turned me in her direction. I opened my mouth, but before I could say anything, the voice from the living death tree was inside me again, saying, "Don't. Don't tell her." "I don't know," I said, stumbling over my words, pulling my arms around my chest to match hers. I think I may have been sleepwalking. Chapter 3. Where All the Good Boys Go. Jared Doyle didn't show up at school the next day. And for most of that morning, I felt like maybe I'd dreamed everything that had happened to me in the past 24 hours. The voice from the living death tree. Jared's memories, which didn't match up with mine. My mother's silence after she'd found me under a dead apple tree in the orchard at 5:30 in the morning, still in my boxers with mud spattering my legs. I hoped it was all a dream, really, because if it was, then my life could go back to normal. Whatever normal was, even if it was completely boring, I'd take it and be glad to be thoroughly bored. I was beginning to doubt everything, myself included. And then the next day, the same thing happened, or didn't happen. Jared wasn't there. Not in the hallways, not waiting out in the parking lot after school. And the day after that, he wasn't there again. So when Friday came around and I still hadn't seen him, I decided I should probably drive over to the trailer on Cordial Run to make sure he actually existed, to prove to myself that he wasn't some bizarre delusion. When I pulled down the ruts of his dirt drive and killed the Blue Bomb's engine, the silence of the back roads rushed at me, surrounding my car like a swarm of bees. Living in this part of Temperance was like living in a vast desert. You wouldn't see another person for miles. You wouldn't hear anything but the wind passing through the trees. At certain hours of the day, a train would go by, clickety-clacking on a set of tracks hidden in the woods behind the trailer, or you'd hear a tractor grinding its engine from some farm half a mile away. Other than that, just birds and crickets chirping. My family lived only a 15-minute drive from this corner of the township, but even in that short distance, there was a difference in the quality of the remoteness. Cars would pass by our place on their way out to Niles, for instance, with hourly regularity, reminding us that we weren't so far away from someone else. Jared and his mom, though, inhabited this great big emptiness of fields and woods and covered bridges. There was something forlorn about it all, living so apart from other people. I went up to the three wooden planks on cinder blocks to the trailer's front door and rapped my knuckles against it, making a trio of hollow thuds. The sound of feet hitting the living room floor like a pair of barbells came a moment later. Then the front door squealed open, and Jared was standing a foot above me, wearing black sweatpants and a gray sleeveless t-shirt, like he was ready for the gym. His hair was all messed up, like he'd just gotten out of bed, and right before I said hello, he stretched his arms above his head and yawned like a bored lion. "What's up, Lockwood?" he asked, after lowering his arms. Before I could answer, though, he turned around, curling the back of his hand to wave me in behind him. "Come inside. I'm not really into daylight at the moment." The trailer was a mess. Clothes littered the living room couch and chairs. A multitude of unwashed plastic drinking glasses sat on end stands, and an ashtray threatened to spill cigarette butts onto the water-stained coffee table. Amid all the mess, a completely chemical floral scent from some kind of recently sprayed aerosol canister clung to the air. Earlier that week, both Jared and my mom had sworn that his mother had put herself back together. But seeing the state of things inside the trailer, I started to wonder. On the other hand, if his mom was working 10-hour split shifts over at Times Square Cafe, like my mom said she was, then it was Jared who should have been cleaning up the place, helping out, especially if he wasn't going to come to school any longer. "I thought I should stop over to see if you were still alive," I said, as I pushed some clothes aside to sit on the couch, its springs squeaking. "Still alive?" Jared said, shrugging. He sat back in an old brown recliner, kicked up its footrest, rolled his head around to work kinks out of his neck like a fighter, then gave me a pearly-toothed grin. "What?" he said. "You miss me or something?" I made a face and rolled my eyes at him. "Or something," I said. Then, "I was just worried that I'd made you up the other day. Had some kind of hallucination. Did you decide to quit school or something?"
"Or something," Jared said.
"Did my mom get you to come over here to grill me?"
"No,"
I said. "I haven't seen your mom in forever. But she did call mine the other day after I drove you home."
"Figures," said Jared.
He rolled his eyes, not at me, but at the idea of his mother.
"She worries like she's trying to make up for the past 5 years all at once."
"Can you blame her?"
"No," said Jared. "It's just a lot to make up for in the span of 2 weeks. That's all."
We didn't say anything for a while. It was like those 5 years of absence he'd mentioned took up all the air in the room. We breathed in those missing years and exhaled them in awkward silence. Eventually, I took out the picture I'd found in my photo album, the one of Jared and me sitting on swings as kids, and passed it over to him without comment. Jared grinned as he looked at it.
"You always did love Superman," he said, shaking his head. "Where'd you find this?"
"My mom had it in a photo album." I paused, not sure how to say what was on my mind. I don't know if I can remember everything from back then very well, I admitted.
No kidding, said Jared.
He looked up from the photo with raised eyebrows.
What happened? You fall down and crack your head a few years back, or what?
If I did, I said, I don't remember doing it. Jared squinted hard, like he was trying to see through to the real me. The me I didn't know anything about.
Really? He said. I mean, you don't remember anything? Nothing at all?
Well, that's it, I said. I can remember things, sure, but I can barely remember you. And there are other things I can't remember, I think, even when I try really hard. Like, most of junior high is gone.
Good riddance, Jared said, and snorted, and I laughed with him, grateful to break the tension, hoping that whatever was wrong with me could continue to be a source of humor.
A minute later, though, I asked the question that had been on my mind since looking through that photo album the night before. Hey, I said. Can you tell me something?
What?
Jared said, lifting his chin a little, looking at me from beneath his furrowed brow. I hesitated. And a flare of heat rushed across my chest, up my neck, over my face, like a wave of lava. I felt completely freakish as I tried to figure out the words I needed to ask the question that burned inside me like a live coal.
Go ahead,
Jared said, nodding to encourage me. His eyes lit up with what might have been hope that I was remembering something he wanted or needed me to remember. Was I, you know, liked by people when we were kids? I don't mean popular or anything like that, but, you know, liked. Because I found this other photo last night along with that one, and it was a picture of you and me and a bunch of other kids we went to school with, still go to school with, actually, at my birthday party. I don't really remember that party, though, or having other kids around that often, and I haven't been close to most of them for years now. You know, I keep to myself. But that picture, when I saw it, it made me think that at some point things had been different. But I can't remember for the life of me. Jared frowned like he felt bad for me, and I thought I saw maybe even a hint of tears in his eyes, like he was attending the funeral of a good friend who had died in an accident.
And was looking down at his dead body, thinking, that's not him.
The way I'd thought when I saw my grandmother in her casket, all made up with colors she'd never have chosen for herself had she been alive.
You were liked, Aiden, Jared said finally, quietly, firmly. Everyone liked you, actually. I mean, you and I were best friends, but you weren't what I'd call a loner back then.
I sat there for a while, absorbing what he'd said, wondering why I wasn't a part of things any longer. Then I looked down at my hands, which I'd folded together on my lap like I'd been praying for something, and saw they were shaking a little.
"You tell your folks about any of this memory loss?"
Jared asked when he saw how troubled I was. I looked up and shook my head. "No, it's weird, but I didn't realize any of this until I saw you on Monday. I mean, sometimes, over the last few years, I'd start thinking about something, but I could never hold a thought for very long. It's like this wall will spring up inside me sometimes, and after that I can't see clearly. Sometimes I'll get migraines if I try to think about something too hard. And, well, I get this feeling like I shouldn't tell my mom and dad what I'm telling you right now. Especially my mom."
Jared wrinkled his nose and said, "Your mom has always been a little odd."
"What do you mean?"
"You know," he said, "telling fortunes and stuff like that. My mom used to go to her after she got out of rehab a few years back, trying to figure out what she should do with herself after she got cleaned up."
"Are you serious?" I said. Jared pulled back and looked like I'd accused him of lying, which I guess was true in that I doubted what he was saying. But I couldn't grasp what he was telling me and recognize it as reality. My mom doesn't do that, I said, shaking my head. I mean, I've never seen her do anything remotely like that, except on occasion, like by accident, at home, with just us around, my dad and Toby and me. We used to joke that she was psychic, but she'd be the first person to tell you psychics are fakes performing for money.
Well, Jared said, according to my mom, she does. Maybe your mom just likes to keep it on the down low.
On the down low? I repeated the words like they were a phrase from a foreign language, squinting as I shaped the syllables.
I've been in Cleveland too long, Jared said, snorting. Or else you don't watch enough TV.
Just keeping it under wraps is what I'm talking about. Oh, I said, still stunned, trying to take everything in. I don't know why she'd do that, though, I said. I mean, yeah, sometimes she knows things before other people do, but it's always random, and it's usually something not that important. Like she gets itchy fingers and thinks it's a sign that money is coming to her, so she goes to play bingo or something. Stupid stuff like that. Half the time she's joking. She's never been someone who just sits down and tells someone's future.
Maybe it's pocket money for her, said Jared. Maybe she's ashamed of it and doesn't want you and your dad or your brother to know about it. Anyway, you should tell your dad about not remembering things if you don't want to tell your mom.
I don't know, I said. I think telling you has been enough. Jared smiled then. A genuine smile, no teasing grin. Softly, he said,
It used to be.
What? I asked, smiling back now, ready for him to deliver a line that would most likely make fun of me somehow.
When we were kids, he said, it used to be enough for you to tell just me your secrets.
I suddenly felt awkward again, like we were talking about someone else, this someone else in the past who happened to be me. I couldn't remember the memories he referenced, though, and my face must have shown as much, because the next thing Jared said was,
You're freezing up on me again, Lockwood. Fine. Let's talk about something else. What's there to do around this godforsaken place anyway?
Not much, I said. Most people drive out to Niles to hang at the mall.
Is that where all the good boys go?
Jared asked. He lifted his chin as he posed the question, like he was challenging me to not be one of the good boys. I shrugged. I don't know, I told him. My parents keep me busy at home. I don't have a lot of time to run around, really. He laughed, repeating my words.
Run around? Sounds like something your mom and dad would call what everyone else calls having fun.
He lifted his hands off the recliner arms and dropped them down hard, like he'd just made a big decision.
Well then, he said, let's take a drive out there and find out what's happening. God knows I could use a little running around right now.
45 minutes later, we strolled into the mall like two cowboys busting through the swinging doors of a saloon, looking up and around at the vaulted ceiling, at the little illuminated fountains, gawking at the Niles City kids who hung out in clusters at various stations, in the sunken garden, in the arcade, on the marbled steps of the platform where the carousel turned round and round, the horses going up and down, riderless, behind them. Stepping into the mall was always a bit like going to Disney World. I was used to Times Square Cafe, the Dairy Oasis, the county fair's two midways, fields of corn and soybeans, Sugar Creek winding through town on its way down to Yankee Lake. The denizens of the mall in Niles might as well have been costumed characters putting on a play. And there were lots of different types of characters, even ones I hadn't anticipated, like Gilbert Humphrey. We were in the food court, sitting in a vast archipelago of white and yellow tables, sipping supersized Cokes when Jared asked,
Is that guy over there what I think he is?
Which guy? I said, looking over my shoulder.
Don't, Jared whispered. Damn it, he spotted us. Here he comes.
Who? I said, still not understanding. Out of the milling crowd of teenagers and mothers pulling children in tow, saying no to all the toy stores they passed, came a local army recruiter. He seemed to materialize a few feet from our table, as if beamed down by a starship, wearing a uniform and a smile, standing tall and proud. "Hey, guys," he said, like we were old friends. And before I could blink, he stood at the edge of our table. "Gilbert Humphrey, Army Recruitment. You boys look like you're getting ready to graduate." I nodded. Jared shrugged. "Well, that's great," said Gilbert Humphrey. "That's good you boys are about to make it out into the world. Bet you're glad school's almost done?" I nodded again. Jared shrugged again. "Sure," we said in unison. "What are you all going to do now?" Gilbert asked. And I could tell immediately where he was going with this. "I'm not sure," I said. "I figure I'll take the rest of the school year to think it over." "Good," said Gilbert, nodding. "No hasty decisions." And then, since I'd made myself unavailable, he looked Jared up and down, spotting potential in his athletic form. "What about you?"
"No idea," said Jared. "I'll probably do the same as him."
He gestured at me with his tower of coke. We were playing hot potato, I realized, throwing Gilbert Humphrey's attention back and forth between us. "Well, in case you boys don't already have this, here's an information packet." He handed us thick envelopes, and we said thanks without looking at them. "We have all sorts of things you guys could do. Want to go to another country? Drive a tank? Amazing stuff out there in the world. Real different from here. And women? Let me tell you about the women."
"Thanks, Gilbert,"
Jared said, as he scraped his chair back and stood.
"We've got to go meet some friends, but it's been nice."
Jared looked down at me, and I stood up like a soldier who's received an order. "My number's in the envelope," Gilbert said as we walked away. And when we finally made it out of his range, I said, "That was awkward."
"Sorry," Jared said. "I should have pulled you out of your seat when I first saw him. Those guys can be persistent."
"He'll never get anyone to sign up like that," I said.
"Sure he will," Jared said. "Even being that annoying, he'll get people. If this place wasn't full of cattle, though, I don't know how he'd convince anyone."
"Cattle?" Jared nodded.
"This whole place, not enough jobs around to give people hope of making a life here. Just enough to keep people breeding kids who have nowhere to go but into Gilbert Humphrey's waiting arms. They've got themselves a real army farm here."
"You really think so?" I said. I never heard Jared sound like this, like he held some kind of grudge against the world. Jared looked at me with raised brows, like he couldn't believe I was so stupid.
"How does it work on your dad's farm?" he asked.
When I didn't answer, he looked almost guilty about even asking the question.
"Come on," he said. "Let's just get out of this place."
"Where to?"
"Wherever you want," Jared said. "We could go to the moon for all I care."
We didn't go to the moon. Instead, we drove out of Niles, took Route 422 east to Youngstown, where the little roadside shopping plazas fell away, to be replaced by boarded-up factories and the collapsing remains of steel mills that had been built along the Mahoning River decades before we arrived in the world. This was our inheritance, these shambling buildings. They'd been left behind to rot in the brown fields of dead earth they once loomed over, their insides gutted like the deer carcasses my dad and Toby brought home from their hunts. "Where are we headed?" I asked Jared, who had fallen silent several miles back. Now he sat in his seat with pent-up emotions smoldering inside him. I could almost see the embers and smoke through his eyes.
"Just keep going until I tell you where to turn," he said,
nodding his chin straight ahead before turning to look out his window. I wondered what was on his mind that made him so sullen so quickly, but I didn't press him. One thing I'd figured out fast about Jared was that his moods could take a left turn at any time, without any apparent reason. And usually when that happened, he gave off a vibe that said more than words. The vibe said, back off. So I backed off. I worried, though, that the reason he seemed able to fall into such a dark place was somehow connected to me. To something I wasn't saying or doing that he wanted me to say, or wanted me to do. Like there was a script out there for us, but I wasn't saying my lines. When I was around him, I felt like a man groping in the dark for a light switch. We only drove a couple more miles before Jared perked up and said, "Here, take a right here," and followed that up with a few more directions. I drove off the highway into a residential neighborhood where old narrow row houses stood side by side like faded soldiers, and a few turns later, after Jared told me to stop, I had pulled into one of the parking lots of Mill Creek Park. When I killed the Blue Bomb's engine, I looked over at Jared and asked, "Why here?" "Time travel," said Jared. One corner of his mouth lifted into a smirk. Then he opened his door and jumped out into the late afternoon sun. We walked from the lot into a large garden with a round stone fountain at its center. A gazebo was perched on a hill in the distance, and to our right, a squared row of hedges held an old-fashioned rose garden inside it, like a secret. At the far edge of the place was a wrought-iron railing that barred people from going any farther, and beyond the railing was a cliff that slid down to Lake Glacier, where even that late in autumn we could see a canoe skimming across the surface like a water insect. Otherwise, the place was empty. "Time travel?" I said, once we were sitting on a bench near the fountain. "You don't remember what happened in this place?" Jared asked. His eyes widened a little, but not like he was angry with me. More like he was trying to pull something out of me. Something I didn't know I had inside me. I shook my head. I hadn't been in this park for years. It was a bit of a drive from Temperance, and what memories I had of Mill Creek were packed in the vague, cottony cloud of my childhood. "Why don't you take a look at that fountain for a minute?" he suggested, and I turned to see where he was pointing. It was an ordinary fountain, as far as I could tell. A circular stone basin with one main font in the center, smaller ones ringing it, their jets sending up a frothy spray over and over on a timer. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be seeing that was so extraordinary. But just as I was about to say that, Jared put his hand on my shoulder and squeezed. "Just keep looking into the water," he said. "Don't think about anything in particular. Just look. Just see." I did what he said, even though I thought he was setting me up for some kind of prank. But as I stared at the fountains going up and down, the light began to change, lowering from late afternoon amber to a lavender dusk. It was the time of day I'd once heard my grandma call the gloaming. It was her favorite time, she used to say, when night and day met for a brief visit, before passing each other on their way to the other side of the world. The fountain continued to spray, and the sound of its rising and falling began to lull me into a daze. My head was thick with the rhythms of sleep and dreaming. But right before I was about to give up on this experiment of Jared's, I saw something, or someone, through the curtain of water. Two boys. Two boys emerged from around a corner of the rose garden hedgerows to enter the circle of benches around the fountain, and they sat down directly across from us, the fountain spraying between us. The fountain lowered a moment later, and I could see them again. Two kids, no more than 12 or 13. One with shaggy brown hair and dark eyes, the other with trimmed curls and green eyes like mine. They were mine, actually, those eyes. Those boys were us, me and Jared. I realized as they leaned toward one another to talk conspiratorially, ignoring us, as if they couldn't see their older selves sitting across the fountain. I opened my mouth to say something, but Jared's hand on my shoulder squeezed harder. "Do you see something?" he whispered, hopeful. I nodded and whispered yes.
Good,
he said.
Don't say anything. Just keep watching.
The boys were talking about something that upset one of them, the younger Jared, and my younger self was telling him not to worry.
It'll be okay,
little Aiden Lockwood said, and I almost blushed to hear how I sounded as a kid, my voice still squeaky.
Here,
he said to the younger Jared, and placed his hand in Jared's.
Let me show you, so you'll know how it will be.
Then both boys closed their eyes and slumped back against the bench, as if all the life had gone out of them in an instant. I could tell that wasn't the case, though. I could see that something was happening between them, that they were having some kind of shared experience. On my own shoulder, Jared's hand still rested, heavy and warm. Then after a minute, the boys opened their eyes and looked at each other. They were smiling now. The younger Jared looked relieved by whatever he'd been shown.
So now you know it'll all be okay,
my younger self told him. Then they hugged, tight and hard, as if they might never see each other again.
Boys,
someone called in the distance. Then they separated to look over at the garden entrance, where a younger version of my mom stood holding her purse open in front of her, pulling out a set of keys.
Boys, we should get going, she said. Jared's mom and dad will be ready to have him back home now, I'm sure.
The boys nodded, then stood and went over to her dutifully. She stroked the younger me on the head and smiled.
What were you two up to over here?
She asked, as if she could sense we'd been doing something we shouldn't have. The younger me said,
We were talking about the future.
My mom's smile fell into a frown when she heard my answer. Then she nodded toward the parking lot and said,
Okay, let's go home now.
As I turned the corner of the hedgerow and disappeared from sight, I finally turned to Jared, my Jared, sitting beside me.
What in the world was that?
I asked. Then Jared said,
That was you showing me the future back when we were 13.
No, really, I said. What was it? Jared sighed, but kept on going.
On the day my dad got tired of my mom drinking and asked for a divorce, your mom took me and you out here so they could figure out what to do next in private.
His hand still sat on my shoulder. When I looked at it, he took it away like he'd just been burned.
What was it that I showed you?
I asked.
What did I show you back then?
Jared leaned over, putting his elbows on his knees, propping his head in his hands, upset that I was still, after that revelation, somehow off script. He tilted his face to look up at me, and his hair flopped across his eyes like a curtain.
This, he said. You showed me this. You showed me us, right now, at this very moment, sitting here like this, talking.
The trip home felt longer than the one we'd taken to get away from the confines of Temperance. Then in the span of time between leaving and returning, though it was only a few hours, it felt like the moon had crashed into the earth, and now every mile of highway I drove down was a desolate stretch of pavement in a world that had come to an end. Because really, even before Jared could get halfway through the rest of his story, everything I thought I knew about the world had truly ended. He told me that he'd hoped the fountain would jog my memory, because it was special. Or at least, it was special to him. He told me that what I'd seen wasn't one of my own memories, but one of his. He'd put his hand on my shoulder because he remembered that I had to be touching someone to show them the things I could see when we were little.
Like what things?
I asked.
And he replied, Like the future.
He said I'd been able to do that when I was little. And he said that I could do something other than see the future. I could show the things I saw to others if I touched them.
You said it was called reaching across, he said now.
and I just sat there shaking my head as I drove by the tired little houses that line the sides of Route 193, like the facades of small towns in old movies. A gust of wind could have blown those houses over. They seemed so flat and unreal right then. After he finished his story, I stupidly asked if he had some weird kind of power. He laughed at me and said, "It's not me, Aiden. It's you. It's you who can do this stuff. It's you who showed me the future. A future where you were happy and living with your mom again," I said. "A future where we were still friends. That's what I showed you?" I looked over, but he hesitated to answer. He seemed worried, began chewing the inside of his cheek nervously, and then he abruptly looked away. "Yeah," he finally said to the passenger window, where I could see his face reflected in the glass, his eyes downcast. He seemed disappointed in something he wasn't saying. I was up to speed enough on him to tell when he too was going off script. "A future where we were still friends," he said, repeating my words in this way that wasn't believable. He reached into the pocket of his jean jacket to take out his cigarettes, but began patting himself down within seconds. "Damn it," he said. "I'm out. Want me to find a gas station?" "No," he said. "We're almost home. And that was my last pack."
"Last pack?" I said. "Really?"
He nodded.
"I told myself I'd quit after I'd smoked the last one. Guess that starts now."
"Why quit?" I asked as we pulled onto his road a few minutes later. The reflective mailbox that stood at the end of his trailer's dirt drive glowed in the distance as my headlights fell on it.
"I guess because you made me feel bad about it the other day at the lake," he said. "And because you're right. I shouldn't smoke if I'm playing ball. I need to save my lung capacity for a running basis."
"You're coming back to school then?" I asked, as I pulled down his rutted drive, the blue bomb shuddering and knocking like it might fall apart around us.
"Yeah," he said.
Then he sighed, long and drawn out, like he was giving up on something other than cigarettes.
"I've got to. Otherwise, I might as well go back to the mall and sign up with Gilbert Humphrey."
I put the car in park and turned off my headlights, but left the engine running. We sat there for a while, staring into the dark. Jared's mom's car was pulled up the drive a little farther. She was probably asleep already, Jared speculated.
"Has to get up for an early shift at Times Square tomorrow," he said as he reluctantly grabbed the door handle.
The door squealed a little as he opened it, and before he pushed himself out, he looked back at me and said,
"What are you going to do about what you saw tonight?"
I looked at my hands gripped on the wheel in front of me and shook my head. "I'm not sure," I said. "I mean, I know what I saw, but I have no clue what to do about it." Jared nodded, then slid off the seat into the dark. Before he closed the door, he leaned down and said,
"Maybe you'll see more things now, at least. Maybe you'll see things that'll answer your questions."
"Can't you just tell me?" I asked. "Can't you just share more memories with me?" He shook his head.
"I don't know the whole story," he said. "Just know my part in it. My dad moved a few weeks after you showed me we'd still be friends in the future. I don't know what happened to you after that, because I went with him. The rest you're going to have to find out on your own."
My hands were white-knuckled in the moonlight, clenching harder and harder. And I sighed like Jared had a minute earlier.
"Hey," Jared said.
He ducked his head farther into the car and put his hand on my shoulder like he had in the park, but there was no vision accompanying his touch this time. Instead of reaching across, as Jared had called what happened between us in the park earlier, he just used words with me.
"Hey," he said again. "I might not know what happens next,
That was always your territory. But I will help you however I can. Chapter 4 Masks Off. If I needed help, it was the sort that might make me feel better about my head being so broken. I knew what Jared was trying to do, though. I knew he was trying to give me whatever parts of myself he could, to help put Humpty Dumpty back together again, but everyone knows the end of that story. It doesn't really work out. At that point, I just hoped I might someday look inside myself and not feel like I was staring into a long, empty hallway. At that point, I wanted the clutter of memories. Good or even bad ones, it didn't matter. I just wanted to feel like there was something to me. Something real I could hold on to. There was something, of course. I just couldn't see it. I was as invisible to myself as I was to anyone. I'd have to make myself seeable then, I decided. And to do that, I'd have to start making new memories instead of worrying about the ones I was missing. So when Jared invited me to a party he wanted to throw for Halloween, I said yes without hesitating. Yes, I said, nodding once, firmly, like I just made a huge decision. And then, after thinking about it a second longer, I asked, "Who else is coming?" We were in the cafeteria for lunch period. Around us, people were talking and laughing, filling the room with the voices of their incredibly normal lives, lives that all of them could remember with great ease. But at our table, in an out-of-the-way corner, everyone felt far away, as if they were on other planets, and we were on a moon base, orbiting at a distance. "Just a few of the guys from the team," Jared said. He took a bite of his pizza, then nodded at someone who was walking by our table behind me. I looked over my shoulder, and sure enough, it was one of the guys from the team, Patrick Morrison. I hadn't held a conversation with Patrick Morrison since the 6th or 7th grade, most likely, and whenever our eyes met now, it was like he looked right through me. Great, I thought. A party. A party with people who don't acknowledge my existence. My instinct was to bolt, to just not go in the end, then apologize for not showing up later. But since it was clear to me by then that I couldn't trust my own instincts, I just nodded and said, "Cool," and hoped it sounded like I meant it. On Halloween morning, as I spooned up oatmeal at the kitchen table before heading off to school, my mom looked over her shoulder as she washed dishes and said, "Hey, if he's not busy tonight, why don't you bring Jared over for dinner?" I swallowed the mound of oatmeal I'd just shoveled into my mouth before shaking my head and saying, "No can do. There's a Halloween party tonight." "A party?" my mom said, and her eyes lit up like she couldn't believe what I was saying. "I don't think I've ever heard that word leave your mouth before." I wasn't sure if my own mother had just cut me down for not being the type of person who got invited to parties, so instead of rolling my eyes at her, I just shrugged and said, "Yeah, at Jared's." "At Jared's?" she said, her voice going up into even higher frequencies of disbelief. Now that her initial shock had passed, she began to shake her head. "In that old trailer? I can't see how any party, at least a good one, can be thrown in that place." "Well, it's just a small party," I said, as if I knew anything about it. "Me, a few guys from the baseball team, maybe some people from his classes." "Girls?" my mom asked, turning back to the sink. A dish squeaked as she wiped it with a wet cloth, and I flinched at the sound of it. "I don't know," I said. "It's not my party. He just invited me." "Well, he must be trying to make friends again," my mom said as she set the dish in the drying rack. "Parties will do the trick, for sure. But don't do anything stupid, okay? First sign of alcohol or drugs, you get out of there." "Mom," I said, looking up from my just-emptied bowl. "I don't think he's going to have alcohol or drugs in his mom's place after what she went through to get off them." "You never know," my mom said, shaking her head. "Just because his poor mother had trouble with all of that and got over it, doesn't mean he's not going to have his own troubles.
Sometimes these things run in families. I dropped my spoon in the bowl and stood to bring it to her, let it slide into the soapy water and clunk against the sink's bottom. "Did you dream that?" I asked, looking straight into her eyes. "Or is that a genuinely concerned opinion?" There was an edge to my voice that surprised even me. My mom's eyes turned to slits in an instant. "Don't you talk to me that way, young man," she said. "I'm just trying to look out for you. It's my job, you know. Being a mother isn't easy." "I'm 17, I said. "I can look out for myself." Then I grabbed my backpack from my chair, thudded down the mudroom steps, and opened the back door. As I stood there with the door still open behind me, my mom got in one last jab. "You think you know everything, Aiden Lockwood," she yelled from the kitchen. "But you don't know the half of it." I shut the door on her voice and shook my head at what she'd said. "Sometimes these things run in families," I whispered into the morning air, as if by saying the words aloud and scoffing at them, I might exorcise the idea they held in their syllables, the idea that none of us can escape the problems of our families. The words turned into a white fog in front of me as soon as I said them, chilled by the late autumn air. They turned into a fog as thick and white as the one inside me. Then they disappeared. For the rest of the day, whenever I looked up from a test or away from my teachers, the clock seemed to have moved far into the future instead of keeping the usual school-like time of never going to end. Before I knew it, the day was half over. And in what seemed like the next moment, the bell for last period rang, and I was walking out the doors. Some people had dressed up because it was Halloween, so it had been a day of costume watching. There was a lineup of mostly bad Lady Gaga renditions, and guys wearing plastic claws with their hair slicked up to look like Wolverine. One girl came as Catwoman, wearing a black leather bodysuit, twirling a fake plastic whip like a tail, which got her sent home by the end of first period. A bunch of the school athletes unimaginatively wore their team uniforms, and some teachers managed to get into the spirit. Mr. Johnson was wearing breeches and tights in an effort to look like Shakespeare, and Ms. Woodyard wore a severe nun-like costume that she continually had to explain was a replica of the garb women might have worn at the Salem witch trials. At the end of the day, all of these masked spirits exited the building together, as if in a parade, then drove off in a hurry toward their various Halloween destinations. Jared was already leaning against the blue bomb when I got outside. It was weird to see him not smoking an after-school cigarette. Apparently that image of him had been branded into my mind. I think it must have been weird for him, too, because he jiggled his leg up and down and kept playing with the lock of his hair like it really needed his attention. The only time I'd seen him look so nervous was when he took me to Mill Creek to show me one of his memories. One of my memories, that is. One of our memories, I should say. "What?" I said as I came up to him, as if just last week he hadn't told me any of those completely unbelievable things. "No costume? Really?" He looked me up and down before he said, "You're one to talk. Jeans and a flannel shirt? Again? One easily purchased hockey mask and you would have been a hit today. So don't go giving me a hard time." "On Halloween," I said, "at least originally, masks were supposed to come off, according to Mr. Johnson. But we are for sure the least fun people in this high school, regardless. Even Ms. Woodyard came dressed for the Salem witch trials." "Huh," said Jared. "I thought that pilgrim dress was one of her regular outfits." I grinned, then was relieved to be grinning. Jared and I had begun to understand each other's sense of humor, dry and cutting in his case, which meant we were getting back to being the way we must have been when we were kids, when we'd understood one another in some way that made us want to be around each other. To be friends. "Need to pick up anything for the party?" I asked. "We have time if you're not ready." "Nah," Jared said, shaking his head. "I've got everything we need. We can head out if you're ready." "Ready," I said, confident as a businessman, even though I had no clue what the fine print on the contract said.
So we got into the blue bomb and headed toward the trailer on Cordial Run, where, when Jared unlocked the front door and pushed inside, the door squealing on its hinges, I found the place in what must have been the cleanest state it had been in since we were kids. The shock must have shown on my face, because Jared said, "My mom said I had to clean if I was going to have people over. I told her it was just you coming, but she said that didn't matter." He looked at me after saying that and laughed at his own joke. "What a guy," I said, and shook my head at him. I'd gotten snagged, though, on what he'd said about it being just me coming, and wondered what had happened to the others. "Didn't you invite anyone else?" I asked. "You said some of the team were coming over." Jared made a face like the guys on the team were some exotic food he'd never try willingly. Octopus or raw fish, maybe. But baseball players? "Nah," he said. "I'll have to hang out with them soon enough, once we start spring training. I figured we could have one of our old horror flick marathon nights, like we used to. For old time's sake." I looked at him for a while, wanting to say I wasn't comfortable with this change in plans, wanting to say I wasn't comfortable doing something we did back when we were kids, because doing that would make me think about all of the other things I couldn't remember us doing. But instead I said, "Sounds fun," and asked, "What do you have in the lineup?" "I'm thinking we should go for a classic first," he said, raising his eyebrows a few times with real excitement that I was good with his change of plans. "Maybe a slasher. Then we can move on to something current, possibly a supernatural thriller. Those were always your favorites. Or we could watch something so bad it's funny." "When we were kids," I said, "we didn't watch scary movies and laugh." I said this with confidence. This much I could remember. "Christ, no," said Jared. "Back then, I believed in the boogeyman. And you seeing all kinds of spooky shit sure as hell didn't help convince me otherwise." I looked down at the orange shag carpeting. It was the same carpet I remembered from when we were kids, and it was probably the same carpet that had been in that trailer before Jared's parents had lived there. Looking at it made me feel a little better, because it was something I hadn't forgotten, a touchstone, something that had leaped the chasm between my past and present, making everything feel continuous inside me, at least for one brief moment. Also, it was easier to look at that carpet and refuse to think about what Jared had said about me seeing spooky shit back then. "Hey," he said, his voice softer now. "I'm sorry, Aiden. I didn't mean to bring that up again." I looked up, sucking in one cheek a little, and said, "It's okay. I'd rather you talk about it than pretend it was never real." "Thanks," he said, like I'd done him a favor. He stood in the doorway between the living room and kitchen, his arms braced on the doorframe above his head. "I'm glad to hear you say that. I hate having to be fake around people. I'm glad I don't have to be fake around you." He turned to go into the kitchen and left me standing there wondering why he would ever have to be fake with anyone. A guy like Jared is usually the sort lifted up on everyone's shoulders because he can throw a baseball past batters and leave a bit of smoke coming out of the catcher's mitt afterward. At least he didn't see things other people couldn't. At least the thing that made him different was a good thing. A minute later, he returned with a couple of beers. "Want one?" he said, holding out a sweat-beaded bottle. I thought about my mom and her prediction that drugs and alcohol would appear at Jared's party. A little anti-drinking commercial played in my mind for a second, and my mom was an actor in it, wagging her finger at me. Why did she always have to be right? I shrugged it off a second later, though. "It's just one beer," I told myself. "And it's just the two of us anyway." And that piece of logic nullified the accuracy of my mom's prediction, just enough for me to not care. I took the cold bottle out of Jared's hand then, and twisted the top off like a trooper. By 10, we'd made our way through two old slasher flicks, Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, and we were just getting to the end of a third movie, Paranormal Activity,
which had been made like a documentary about a demon-possessed woman whose boyfriend won't stop filming her.
"What an idiot," Jared said, shaking his head as the movie ended.
"She kept telling him to stop filming her," I said.
"No means no, dude. You get what you deserve."
Jared chuckled and took a swig from his bottle. We were on our fifth beers, and I was feeling fuzzy around the edges. A different fuzzy than how I usually felt. This felt like I was somehow lighter, like some kind of pressure had been relieved. This felt like the opposite of those times when a migraine would come for me. When Jared finished his beer a second later, he stood and went to the kitchen to retrieve the last two, then came back with the top already taken off mine.
"I don't think you should drive home tonight," he said as he stretched to pass me the bottle. "I couldn't live with myself if you got into an accident after drinking over here."
"I guess I could stay here," I said. "I just have to call my parents and tell them."
"Sure," Jared said. "Just don't sound drunk when you talk to your mom, or she'll be over here in a hurry to get you."
"It sounds like you've had practice at doing this," I said, laughing. Jared laughed too.
"Okay, okay," he said. "You've got me. But learn from my mistakes, grasshopper. Practice makes perfect."
So I practiced talking out loud for a while, just to make sure I wasn't slurring my words, which I didn't do at all. Which surprised me. I'd always expected that the first time I drank anything alcoholic, I wouldn't be able to stand, let alone talk coherently. The beer, though, hadn't hit me hard. Probably because it was the cheapest stuff Jared could find in the coolers of the shadiest little convenience store in the next town over. After all that practice at talking sober to fool my mother, though, it turned out to be my dad who answered the phone when I eventually called. He said staying over at Jared's was fine, but he expected me home early enough to help him with chores the next morning. I said, "Sure thing, will do. Thanks, Dad." And when I clicked my phone off a second later, Jared slowly raised his fists into the air, shaking them victoriously, like we'd just won a championship ball game.
"Come on," he said,
and got up to lead me back to his room. While the carpet in the trailer was something I remembered from hanging out there as a kid, Jared's room seemed different. It was the size of a matchbox, made even smaller by his bed, which was this huge sleigh-shaped thing that barely fit. It took up most of the space, leaving only a person-sized path to walk around its edges. In my memory, the room had been way bigger. Maybe, though, I only remembered it like that because I'd been a lot smaller.
"You can have the bed," Jared said, nodding toward it. "I'll sleep on the floor."
I looked at that narrow strip of free space around the edge of the bed and said, "No way. That won't be comfortable at all."
"I've slept in worse places," Jared said, shrugging.
I wondered what he meant, but didn't ask. "I can sleep out on the couch," I offered instead, turning back to the living room. "I don't mind. Really?"
"No," he said. "My mom will come through there when she gets home from work, and if she smells beer on you, she'll go crazy. I already put the other evidence in the trash can out back. I don't usually have anything around to set her off, but I figure what she doesn't know can't hurt her."
"It's your call," I said. "But it's also your bed. Why don't I take the floor instead?" Jared opened his mouth, but for a moment he just stood there, saying nothing, as if he'd lost all of his words. A strange look passed over his face. Then quickly he sat down on the edge of the bed, put his elbows on his knees, his head in his hands, and he started to mutter, saying how stupid he was.